What is up, WTD listeners? We are back for episode 3. We were lucky enough to have former Oregon quarterback Mike Jorgensen with us today. Jorgie played quarterback for the Ducks between 1981 and 84, and for the last 30 years has been the official color analyst for Oregon football's local radio broadcast. Thanks for listening, and hope you enjoy.
So you're an in-state kid, and you got a chance to be a starter and started games in 82, 83, 84. So paint the scene of what Oregon football was like at that point, from facilities, just the notoriety and the overall feel of the program.
Well, I'll tell you, it was, you know, when I got here in 1981, it was coming off a really good year with Reggie Ogburn at the quarterback position and a defense that had a bunch of studs. And I think they finished that year 6-3-2. They had a couple of ties and had a winning record, but not bowl eligible because there weren't that many bowls at that point in time. And so the biggest thing for Oregon at that time was replacing a really dynamic quarterback in Reggie Ogburn. And there was a guy named Kevin Lusk that had been Reggie's backup that started that following year. And the year didn't start great. Kevin's a really good quarterback and a guy that had been there a couple of years, but he got hurt early on in the season, which actually in 81, you mentioned 82, 3, and 4, ended up having to actually start some games in 81, my true freshman year, because of injury to Kevin Lusk. And there was myself and a guy named Mike Owens that took over for him, and we struggled. We struggled. Offense that was good, a defense that was great. Unfortunately, we let the defense down an awful lot with two young rookie quarterbacks trying to run the offense that was full of some upperclassmen that were pretty good players. And so those first couple of years in 81 and 82, we struggled with only a couple of wins both those years. But what was really neat, and again, coming from the state of Oregon and yet being clear on the other side of the state of Oregon over in Ontario, basically Idaho, you know, that's dominated by Boise State over in the valley over there. And at that time, it was a 1AA school. It wasn't the type of school that it is now. But that's all I really read about, saw, didn't see a whole lot about Oregon State. So I really didn't understand until I was getting recruited how well Oregon was playing up until those 2 years. And we struggled. Defense played great. Offense really struggled to score points. And in 1983 is where things kind of turned. You know, the crowds weren't great. We were lucky to get the COVID crowds that you might see our games on a regular basis. You know, front row parking was great. Everybody could just drive right up 5 minutes before and you could walk right in and get a fight for a parking spot. And 83 kind of started off that way. We struggled a little bit early, but we got it going and actually had kind of turned a corner in 1983 and playing some pretty good football, building our way back to being a 500 team. Chris Miller had a little bit to do with that at the end of the season. And then the beginning of the next season, I had beaten him out for the starting job, but at the same time, I struggled, didn't play well at all in the first few games. He took over from there, and the rest is history. We got better and better that year, finished 6-5, again, not bowl eligible because we're bowl eligible, but not enough bowls at that point in time. But he really helped turn the corner. And to be honest with you guys, I got to tell you, that's probably the funnest, most enjoyable year I had my whole career here over the 4 years, was playing as his backup that senior year. I don't know what it was. Number one, love Chris to death. He's a great friend. Just watching him grow and what he does, let alone the silly type of athlete he was. I still to this day, and you guys know over time, there's been some really, really good Oregon quarterbacks since Chris Miller, but the best all-around athlete I've ever been around. Football, baseball, basketball, just an absolute golf. He touches it, you name it, it's just a natural. And of course, he became a great NFL quarterback too. But those 4 years were really completely different. First 2 years, a struggle. The last 2 years, pretty good, particularly 1984 when Chris took over as a starting quarterback.
Well, and I kind of just want to take it back a little bit. So you were an in-state kid from Oregon. What did that mean? Kind of growing up, watching a team, like rooting for the Ducks and being able to play for them finally.
Yeah, well, I tell you, the biggest honor at that time, and like I mentioned, growing up on the east side of the state, I really didn't root for them, to be honest with you, or Oregon State or any of the schools on this side of the state, because at, you know, at that point in time, that just the social media and the attention and that type of deal wasn't really brought over in the Eastern Oregon Mountain time zone. The Mountain time zone was really dominated by Utah or maybe Washington State a little bit, because my dad had gone to the University of Idaho, so I knew a little bit about them up there. And that type of deal. So I didn't really grow up a fan. It's, you know, as interesting as that is, it, you grow up in the state of Oregon and yet really don't know anything about the state schools. But what was really neat was being recruited as an in-state kid late my junior year in high school, my senior year in high school in particular, making the trips over to here in Corvallis and in other schools on the West Coast that were recruiting me, and realizing what it meant to be an in-state kid. At that point in time, I can tell you, it was an overwhelmingly, I won't say overwhelming majority, but probably half the kids on the team, half the players on the team were in-state kids. You know, the other half were from California or maybe a little bit of Washington, but there were far more Oregon kids on the team at that time here and in Corvallis and that type of deal. So all of a sudden you were seeing guys you played against in high school or you played an all-star game with, or whatever else it might be. And so it became real exciting. And it was just a distinct difference between here and Corvallis and the coaching staff here versus the coaching staff with Joe Avezzano at the time. It was just Rich Brooks and the staff that that he had was just fantastic. So all of a sudden, Oregon and Oregon football was front and center. And I started to realize what it meant to be a kid from in-state playing for an in-state school.
Definitely. And I'm glad you mentioned Rich Brooks, because that was kind of where I wanted to go from here. So towards that, the end of your high school career, there was a scandal at Oregon that he kind of got caught up in. And I know those, the impact of that was sort of felt while you were there as well. But as you mentioned, there weren't a lot of bowls to begin with. So a bowl probation isn't as bad as it would be today. But how much did it influence your love of football or reaffirm it to be in a situation where it was pretty unlikely to make a bowl game, but you could still have a great football Division 1A football experience?
Yeah, you know, I mean, for me, obviously, as important as the football was, what was the academic side of it too here at the university, and that probably every bit as much as the football. You know, I don't want to say you never come in as a high school senior, college freshman thinking you can't get to the next level. But when you arrive and you see some of the talent that's here versus, you know, the talent you were playing against at Ontario, against Baker City or LeGrand or Hermiston, or not, again, love playing with those guys and against those guys, that type of deal. But it wasn't anything like it was when you got here. So I quickly realized that, you know what, you're going to have to compete for everything that you do. But, you know, bottom line, it was for me, whether you thought you could get to a bowl or not, you knew you were playing in one of the best leagues in the country. And at that time, I know the Pac-8, Pac-10,
right,
as it became, and then Pac-12 over time, was considered one of the best conferences in the country, with UCLA and USC and Washington. I think 3 of the 4 years, if not 2 of the 4 years, was ranked number one when we played them in the country and that type of deal. So you were considered one of the real high-level power conferences. And that, to me, is what attracted me the most, is to be able to compete at the highest level, because what it does is it brings up really the level of your skill. I mean, you have to play up, and if you don't, you're going to get eaten alive. So, and I think that became real apparent when I got here, let alone just the intensity of the practices and the intensity of the coaches, particularly Coach Brooks. And if you weren't focused every day, he'd let you know. And so it taught me a lot of new lessons, and I give a lot of credit to him.
Absolutely. And I'm assuming that some of the sanctions that the program faced probably created for some morale issues and whatnot on the team. And if there was any, how are the guys able to kind of rally back from that and kind of be inspired to keep working towards their goals?
Yeah, it's a good question. And to be honest with you, I really don't remember the morale issues. Frankly, I got to tell you, and again, it's amazing this day and age versus that time, how public information was like that, how it became part of a decision you make of a school to go to or to not go to. We really didn't pay, or I should say this for everybody, but I didn't really pay attention to that. And in fact, I don't think I really realized until I was already here that that was even going on, to be honest with you. And at the same time, I think when you're a student athlete, when you're 18 to 22 years old, other than in this day and age where everything is so public and players are watching Twitter and watching everything else and that type of deal as to the latest thing that happens that could scare them away from a school, I really don't think it had any impact on the way that we played, the enthusiasm that we played with, the teamwork that we tried to play with, the respect that we had for the coaches. You know, I don't remember the details of what had happened at that time. I think it was some sort of credit card phone usage or something like that. But at the same time, I think all of us played for the coaches and played for each other, and we were here because we wanted to be here regardless of what was going on.
Definitely. And I did like what you brought up earlier about just how physical football was at that point. And that's what I've always wondered. So at that point, obviously two-a-days were still a thing. And how much more physical was football? And maybe more so than that, how much more grueling was a season than maybe it is now when, like, there's off days and lighter days? Like, was it just full-on hitting every day? Or how did that –
Yeah, I mean, Coach Brooks was a guy who liked full contact scrimmage, full contact practices. Usually Tuesday and Wednesday would be your heavy days for sure. Monday would kind of be the day, Sunday you would get in the pool or do other things to loosen up your muscles, and Monday would be kind of a light pads day. But on Tuesday, Wednesday, we hit. And sometimes it created some injury type of situations too, but it was always, for the most part, 2 days a week. Full contact practice, and you just had to be mentally prepared for it and to get through it and to compete, because if you didn't come each down, somebody else was coming. And so I think it made us a better team. It made us a more physical team, particularly again on defense in the first 2 years, 81 and 82, when we had players like, Mike Walter and Bill Lauder on defense and Steve Brown at cornerback, who later on played in the NFL. When those guys are going hard every day at the speed and the ability that they did, you just had to raise it. And so, daily doubles were a thing. That's what you did every day. There would be days where you might not go full pads every day, or one of the practices, they'd give you a little bit of a break so you weren't beating up on each other so much. But the daily doubles were a routine thing when you came in August in the heat of those days. And we actually, one year in particular, and it might have been my junior year, I think after we played, I think we'd gotten beat by somebody like Pacific or somebody like that that wasn't very good, is we went back to daily doubles in season, because Coach Brooks was so ticked off. It was crazy. I can't believe we did that. We went back to daily doubles in preparation for the University of Houston that was coming to town. So and we ended up actually beating him. So he kind of got his point across, but it just was different. Yeah, it was different. And not that today's game isn't physical. It is. I mean, the speed and the size and the athletic ability of the players overall is at a different level than it was even then. But boy, it sure seemed physical to me, I can tell you that.
Yeah, that's quite the anecdote. And that was during classes too? Like, you guys had class? This was.
I don't think we were in classes yet. September prior to school. Yeah.
Gotcha.
Absolutely. And I kind of just want to fast forward it about half a decade, and now you're the new color commentator of the Oregon Sports Network. Could you possibly tell us a story about how you landed this gig?
Yeah, it was kind of interesting. It was my first job out of college was with the university as a fundraiser for the Duck Athletic Fund. They hired me and sent me down to Medford, and great area, had a ball doing it. And so I was a fundraiser for the University of Oregon at that time. And, one of the things that came up at that particular time, there was a gentleman by the name of Todd McKim that was a sports guy here for KZI. Locally, he's down actually at the University of California. He's their sideline reporter and does a lot of other things for the University of California. And so he was, at that point in time, was the color analyst along with Jerry Allen when Jerry had taken over in about 87, I think it was, or so. I just met him in Medford, and then he takes off. And He was the play-by-play guy. Todd was the color analyst. And at about that point in time, there was a network that had come along, kind of the first of what now was the Pac-12 network and was previously some other all kinds of names, but it was called Prime Sports Northwest, I think is what it was called. And they would do about three or four games a year on TV. And I believe it might have been even Joe Ginsante was the play-by-play guy potentially, and Todd was the color analyst. And he would switch across from radio to TV for those four games. And so Jerry and the radio network at that time asked me if I'd be interested. And I was a speech and communications major in college, so I could put a word or two together, which always helped. And I watched the game a little bit differently from a quarterback perspective. As a QB, I mean, not only do you have your own responsibilities, but you better know what the defense is doing, how they're lining up. You better make sure that your offense is in position to do what they're supposed to do. Receivers lined up properly, protection called out properly. And you're doing all of that because of what you see on the other side of the line of scrimmage, what the defensive line is doing, how the linebackers line up, what the coverage looks like, where the safety lines up. So you watch a little bit of a different game. And so it ended up just working really, really well. My very first game was Oregon at the University of Iowa. Bill Musgrave, Derek LaVille, they went back there and put a whooping on a Hawkeye team that was supposed to do the opposite to the University of Oregon. And it was an absolute blast, and it just worked. It worked really well where Jerry and I had a chemistry in 89. In 1990, when I first started doing it full-time, that's when Prime Sports Northwest started doing every game on TV. So Todd went over to TV full-time. I stepped in and took the radio job full-time, and the rest is history. I mean, 30-plus years later, it's amazing how quickly time has flown. But, gosh, it just worked so well. And Jerry made it easy. And, frankly, we knew each other before that, so that made it easier. And right now, there's such a chemistry that's built and built really quickly, frankly. I'm surprised how quickly the chemistry built to where it is right now.
Yeah, I've listened to you guys so much over the years, but I do want to go back. So feels like right as soon as you got that job, Oregon football kind of takes a turn for the better. Rose Bowl 94, winning seasons kind of became the regular there, even before the BCS days. And I think you had a unique perspective just being a guy who witnessed some of those lean years and down years. So how did that influence the way you were able to appreciate that turnaround and maybe understand how significant it was for Oregon to be in the Rose Bowl in 94?
Yeah, I mean, we still pinch ourselves. I look at pictures all the time. I think at that time, our sideline reporter might have been Mike Barrett. He was an announcer, a TV announcer, and you hear him on all the different commercials nowadays, it seems like. And I think he was our sideline reporter, and we had the cheesy mustaches and the long hair and everything else that goes with it. It was pretty funny. But just to walk into the stadium that day, and you dreamed to maybe get there once because it just wasn't the norm. It was the norm to see USC or UCLA or Washington in that game. It seemed like almost every single year, you just never thought you'd get there. And if you did, it might be one time in your lifetime, which is, as we've learned real quickly, has become a lot more regular. But it instantly made you look back and go, look how far these guys have come. Look at all of the coaches and the student athletes and the administrators and the fundraisers and the volunteers and everybody that had kind of contributed along the way to get there. All the things that had to happen to kind of get there. And then let alone to have those guys make some magical plays that year to be able to do what they did and to have Danny O'Neill and have that gangrene defense and Dino Filia and a pretty good offense and Josh Wilcox and all the little things that happened during the year that you kind of look back over and the previous years that kind of led up to that, you just pinched yourself. You had goosebumps walking into the granddaddy of them all and seeing the stadium and seeing the Oregon name painted in the end zone. I mean, that was probably the highlight of all. Look at this. It's painted in the end zone in the Rose Bowl. We might not ever say this again. Get out there and take pictures. And But that wasn't the end. It's gotten better since then. So it was really neat to see kind of the culmination of at least the 15 years or so I've been associated with the University of Oregon. I can't imagine for some of the other old timers that came before me how exciting it was for them, you know, since the late 1950s, to be able to show up there. So
I think another cool part of your job that, at least I think from my perspective, is that as a former quarterback, you get to see a lot of these guys who go on and play in the NFL. You get to see them as freshmen and sophomore. I mean, Drew Bledsoe, Ryan Leaf, Matt Leiner, Joey, Kellen Clemens, all these guys, Marcus. When you see them as freshmen or sophomores for the first time, and then you see them later on in the NFL, like, can you tell, like, as a former quarterback, when you see a guy that's that kind of generational first-round quarterback kind of talent?
Sometimes. Not always. I mean, you know, usually the highly coveted recruits that you pick up, for the most part, four-star or in particular five-star, those guys end up panning out exactly that way. You know, maybe not a top 10 pick in the NFL when it comes time, but they end up being a really high-level quality player in college and usually end up having a pretty successful career in the NFL. But I tell you, there's been some of the, you know, some of the anomalies that frankly, you don't expect to turn out that way. I look at a guy like Chad Cota, you know, who had a great career with the Panthers and that type of deal. And, you know, coming out of Ashland High School, where he went to high school at the time, I can remember Oregon was just had to see more, needed to see more before they were ever going to step out and offer him a full ride scholarship. And I think their opportunity was, I think, in the state playoffs when they saw the type of player he was when he came to Autzen Stadium, frankly, when he played him there and that type of deal is, you know, they hadn't offered him until the very last minute. Not a whole lot of people have. You know, let alone Justin Herbert. I mean, there's a prime example right there recently where, you know, for the most part, I don't think he had a 1A offer until Oregon threw one out there, and yet you see what he's become. And Chad Cota was the same thing. And so you get those anomalies that just end up being guys that work their rear end off, they're driven. There's more talent there than, you know, being a guy that runs a 4.38 and bench presses, you know, 225, 35 times. Sometimes you don't have to be that to be the type of player that can get to the next level. So, you know, there's been some, but I could tell you most of the time, the guys stick out, and you know it's just a matter of time and maturity and, frankly, repetition before they become that unbelievable player that you've seen at other schools, other places in the country, non-league games that we played, Pac-12 games, you know, the Aaron Rodgerses of the world and stuff like that. You can just see it when you see those guys. You go, oh, God, that guy's going to be pretty good. So, and it's happened here too.
Definitely, and you mentioned it's happened here. I know there was a pretty big stretch of time where what happened at practice at Oregon was pretty secretive. But in your role, was there ever a time you could remember going to a practice at Oregon and maybe seeing a redshirt freshman or somebody who just really jumped out at you like, wow, like this guy is going to be something?
Yeah, you know, over all the years, it's tough to remember kind of some of those guys that are. I can tell you recently, and this is funny, I don't know why he just comes to mind, but I can remember Jerry Allen and I were out of the practice, and I think it's while the practices were still, you know, pretty private. You had to call ahead and make sure you got permission, if you were a letterman, for example, to be able to get into practice, and they wouldn't allow the media in. So Jerry and I were able to, because we were, as part of the Oregon broadcast group, they would allow us to come watch the practices. And there was one day where Jerry and I were standing on the sideline watching this special teams drill, and it was where they would basically – throw, they wouldn't kick the ball down the field, but they'd throw the ball down the field like it was a punt return or like a kick return. And the kick returner, punt returner had to stay within about a 10-foot wide, about maybe 10, 15-foot wide area and try to make a move on whoever the tackler was coming at. So it was one-on-one drill, had to stay within the boundaries of a small area, but full speed. And Charles Nelson, who became, you know, obviously a multi-position player, not the biggest guy in the world, but a punt returner, kick returner, slot wide receiver, safety at times and that type of deal. He made three or four open field form tackles in a row on big time speed guys that we'd never seen. I mean, it was just one of those ones where the guy's trying to make moves and he just drilled it. And the next time, the next guy tried to make a move, just drilled it. Like four times in a row, right in the chest or right up under the chin. And Jerry and I looked at each other and went, oh, my God, this guy, for his size, is going to be really something special. And he was. I mean, he was a great special teams player. Again, not just as a return guy, but as a coverage guy. Time after time, when we saw that his freshman year and thought they can't keep him off the field. And again, why he sticks out when you think about all the other great players that Oregon's had, he's a guy that, you know, when you're at practice, certain guys make certain plays. Royce Freeman's another one. DeAnthony Thomas is another one. They just had something that was different, and you can see it from the get-go.
Absolutely. And, you know, obviously we exploded into the, like, elite college football scene in 2009 and kind of rode that wave, and Oregon became like a huge national football brand. And basically, from your perspective, going on 30 plus years, do you ever have one of those like, oh man, like pinch me moments, and look down when you look down at the field and kind of see how things have evolved?
Yeah, you do. I think we do every year. I mean, you know, there's been some years in between. Again, not much since 2019. There were a few, obviously, post Marcus and that type of deal. But at the same time, most of those years have been spectacular. And we do. That's one thing I think that I absolutely love in doing these broadcasts with Jerry Allen, frankly, let alone with the respect that all the coaching staffs that we've ever worked with and the players, too. After you're around long enough and they get to know you, they treat you with, and you do pinch yourself because you just can't take this for granted. I think, I don't know who does. I'm sure some people do that this is the norm, but it's not. I mean, the hard work to get to this level, let alone to stay at this level, is so, so tough. And the work that everybody puts in from top to bottom and everywhere in between for us to be able to enjoy what we do and to be able to pinch ourselves, absolutely. That's one thing I think that Jerry and I have always looked at each other and said, don't ever take this for granted. Don't take it for granted that this is always the way it's going to be. You know, hope it is. I think all Duck fans hope that's going to be the case, and I do too. But we constantly pinch ourselves when we walk into, when we go play Tennessee at Neyland Stadium, when we saw all the red at Nebraska, when you're in the horseshoe at Ohio State, when you're in the Rose Bowl, which the granddaddy of them all still tops them, even though it's great to play in those national championship games against Ohio State in Jerry World and down in Phoenix against Auburn. There's nothing like going back to the Rose Bowl. And I got goosebumps right now just thinking about it. I mean, it's just talking about it right now, those type of things that it never gets old. And it never, never gets old. And you always pinch yourself because it's just, you got to appreciate the moment. And because it doesn't last forever. But I hope it does. Boy, I hope it does.
No, I think we all do. And I think I speak for a lot of people when I say, hopefully we get a chance this year to listen to your calls in the games. I know some of that's still got to be sorted out, but I can definitely speak for myself when I say that I usually turn off the road broadcast and just put you guys on radio and listen. So thanks for you. This was fun, and you know, we'll hopefully do this again sometime in the future.
Anytime, guys. Thanks for having me on. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. Good day.
Thanks again for listening all the way to the end. Don't forget to follow our Instagram at WTDPod. Be sure to check back next week for more Duck content.